I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on 89.9 KCRW and KCRW.com. While you're nursing your Thanksgiving food coma, we're serving up leftovers. Today on the show, from pasture to the plate, one culinary school has slaughter on its syllabus. How to make bread at home by barely touching the dough, and food that's cute enough to eat.
They form the food into various shapes. It could be their favorite cartoon character, it could be anything.
But first, let's see what's in season at the Santa Monica Farmers Market this week.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. We're visiting with Sal Marino, who is the owner of Il Grano restaurant in West L.A. Today, Sal, as always, you're shopping. You're visiting at Jerry Rutas's stand. I saw that beautiful box of peppers you had. I couldn't help but asking, what are you going to make with it?
Yeah, well, these peppers, I actually serve them at La Bottega, which is the casual concept. We have one adjacent to the Il Grano, Larchmont, and we're actually opening Beverly Hills this weekend.
Oh, congratulations.
Yeah, Roxbury and Little Santa Monica.
Fantastic.
And in Italy, we call them diavoletti, which means little devils, because they're sweet peppers, but you always get maybe a spicy one sneaking in there. So what we do, basically, take all the peppers, throw them in a bottle of boiling water, two parts water, one part white wine vinegar, just a little bit of salt, maybe a bay leaf. Basically, you're just blanching them, taking them out. Cut the top off, but keep it attached to one part, and take all the seeds out. Separately, we'll get two cans of tuna, Italian tuna, canned under olive oil, and we'll just break it in a bowl with half of lemon juice, coarse chopped parsley, a dozen capers, and a half of anchovy, just chopped all together. And you make a stuffing, put it into a pastry bag, and you stuff these little peppers. Now, in Italy, we serve these a lot and on the antipastis, and it's a perfect time. I buy actually a case, whoever has all of them, because we take them, and then you can put them in mason jars, fill them with olive oil, boil them for an hour and a half, and you have them for the whole winter, and it's a perfect antipasti.
Stuffed?
Stuffed. These stuffed little lipstick peppers. Some people call them calabrese peppers. Uh-huh. And they're stuffed with this anchovy. Some of the people in Italy put the whole anchovy inside mm-hmm. for decoration with a big caper. Mm-hmm. But I just basically make this stuffing, throw them in there, and they're served three per plate. A little bit of the olive oil dripping.
Yeah. And, so they never have to be put back in the oven. It's a cold filling in a pre-cooked pepper shell, and they're done.
Done.
And the lipstick pepper is a short, kind of a stubby red pepper, very bright red, normally very sweet, with a very thick skin, right?
Skin.
Thick flesh, yeah.
Yes, uh-huh. You don't have to peel it or mm-hmm. anything.
Okay, and tell us again, now, where is Il Grano?
Okay, Il Grano is on 11359 Santa Monica Boulevard, mm-hmm. West of the 405.
Right near the New Art.
Adjacent to that is La Bottega Marino, our mm-hmm. casual concept that I have with my brother Mario.
Okay.
And then the new one in Beverly Hills opening this weekend.
Where's the one in Beverly Hills?
9669 Santa Monica Boulevard, Little Santa Monica
yeah.
Boulevard.
Great to see you at the market always.
Grazie,
and that's
thank
a lovely
you.
Dish. Thanks so much.
Yes, come and enjoy them.
I'll try
to make it yourself.
Okay.
Ciao.
Bye-bye. That was Sal Marino, and he's got that wonderful dish for the little tiny stuffed lipstick peppers. And like he said, you can eat them now or you can preserve them in oil. We're visiting with Troy Regeer, who is our harbinger of satsumas. And satsumas are the wonderful fall tangerines that come in right around, just in time for Thanksgiving. And Troy Regeer is coming in from Reedley. He's got wonderful satsumas. He's well known for his sweet satsumas. So tell us, Troy, how's the fruit this year? How's the crop going? And how long are you going to have them?
Well, the crop is really nice. We have a large amount on the tree. And this is our second week, and they're really sweet already. And the nice thing about them, they're easy to peel. Kids love them. And one tangerine, actually, believe it or not, you get your recommended daily dose of vitamin C.
That's right. And they're so easy to peel. There's no downtime in between your first one and your second one. Now, these have a tiny bit of green on them still. What does that mean?
It's the first of the season, and I would say maybe by two or three more weeks, the green will be all gone. They'll be totally orange. But come by and try them, because don't let that fool you. The taste is really good. It's going to be a good year.
So the green doesn't really indicate their level of sweetness?
Not really. Most of the commercial guys have picked them green, and then they try to color them up and then sell them. But we try to let them get ripe and color pick them and pick the most orange we can. But like I say, in 2 weeks, they're all going to be orange, and by Christmas time, we'll probably have some complaints that they'll be too sweet. So you never can please everybody, but they're one of my favorite fruits. I was eating them all day yesterday when we were picking them. So, I mean, they're really getting good. Big difference from last week already.
You can tell. And the great thing about them, too, is that they store on the tree. And so they keep getting sweeter and sweeter and sweeter every week. And you're guaranteed when you get them at the market, they were picked, what, you picked yesterday?
Yeah, always the day before I come to market. Nothing's ever in cold storage, so they're always fresh. And the nice thing about tangerines versus, like, stone fruit or peaches like that, they have a long shelf life. So you don't have to, they're not so perishable. You can pick them and put them on your shelf for a week, 2 weeks sometimes, and not worry about it. And when you want one, you just peel it and eat it.
And then you have these adorable little 10-pound boxes. You're boxing them up now for people. They can take these little totally closed boxes and take them as gifts.
Yeah, last year we had a big box, and they were a little too big for people. Now we have a box that's 10 pounds, and they're
$20. $20 for 10 pounds. How much are they by the pound?
They're $3 a pound on the table.
That's
a
great discount.
Yeah,
wow.
It is. A lot of families buy a lot because the kids start eating them, and the moms say, I didn't buy enough, So that's what they get.
Glad you got a good crop this year.
Yeah, thank you. Good to be here.
That was Troy Regeer with his wonderful Satsuma tangerines. Easy to peel. Anybody can peel them, and you will eat five at a time. I do that all the time. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Every week, Laura Avery takes pictures for the Good Food blog. You can find her post at kcrw.com/goodfood. Next, culinary schools are everywhere. They all teach proper knife skills and how to make a perfect consommé. But there's one school that shows its students how that meat started out being an animal and ended up as an ingredient. Stay tuned to Good Food on KCRW and kcrw.com. Culinary students work hard. Some even spend time on the farm, learning the backbreaking work that it takes to bring those beautiful ingredients from the farm to the kitchen. But at the Culinary School of the Rockies, there's one additional, if optional, experience. Dispatch a lamb and prepare it for eating. Adam Dooley is a chef instructor at the school. Tell us about the Culinary School's farm-to-table externship and what the goal is for the aspiring chefs.
Well, the goal of the overall program is designed to give the students a farm-to-table aspect, and we believe we're the first school to offer this program. And we decided the aspect for going into the North Fork Valley when we did would really bring it around for working on the farm, seeing what the farmers go through, going through the entire process of bringing the food from the ground to the kitchen to the plate.
Do students love it?
They do. It's actually taken on quite a lot of interest with them, and they've really gotten involved. A lot of them have actually expressed interest in wanting to have farms in their restaurants or do an extra internship on a local farm here in Boulder to gain more knowledge and appreciation for the food.
Oh, that's fantastic. Now, I know that the students spend 2 weeks actually working on the farm, and although it's not mandatory, part of the experience there is for the students to slaughter, to skin, and to prepare a lamb. Why did you choose to include this in the curriculum?
It really actually, when presented to us, is an incredible opportunity. There's so many people that don't get to participate in something like that. And today, so often, many people don't put together what they see in the grocery store wrapped in plastic or in the meat case there, where it actually came from. And this really brings it down to the level of understanding. For me, one of the things that I wanted the students to walk away from with it was respect for the animals, so that when they are in their kitchens or in their homes or doing dinner, that they understand fully where everything came from, and instead of seeing that little scrap on the side of the table of throwing it away, to actually think back to what went into it and get full utilization.
So describe what some of the students' reactions are. Do pretty much all of them choose to do it, or do quite a few opt out?
Initially, we thought a few of them were going to opt out of it, but by the time that we got around to it, a couple people did opt to not watch the actual slaughter part. But once that kind of came about, there was almost a transformation from that it was a sheep to now it's lamb, and we're going to marinate this and roast this whole and present this dinner to 100 people on a farm on top of a mesa in just one of the most beautiful places in Colorado. So we'd spend individual time with the students to really walk them through why we were doing the process and what the farmers had intended to do with this, and really how it comes about is the wholeheartedness of being able to have a farm being able to self-contain itself.
Maybe share a story of a student who was particularly transformed by the experience.
Oh, definitely. One of our students, Carrie, jumped in hands-on with the first one we did was the bison. And in doing that, she really found something within herself that she didn't think she had before. And so when we got to doing the lamb, she jumped right in and helped hold the lamb. And actually, during the slaughter part of the process, was to actually take a moment and relax and calm the animal before the actual event happens. Because again, they don't know what's happening. You know, they're just the lamb that's there. And she jumped wholeheartedly into it and really got the whole start to finish respect for the use of the product and where it came from, and really changed a lot about what she thought she wanted to do and how she looked at restaurants and food.
Do any of the students ever decide that they want to get more involved in butchering? It seems that old-fashioned butchering seems to be falling so much by the wayside. It would be wonderful if more young people didn't only want to be chefs, but wanted to learn more about preparing animals for cooking.
Oh, definitely. When we came back from the North Fork Valley and we were back here in Boulder, we did a second dinner. And for that, we brought in a hindquarter of a cow, which weighed about 380 pounds, and went through the breaking down of that. It's one of the things that myself, when I went through my training, really focused on because I enjoyed that and learned the respect and the utilization from it. And I've been passing that along to them as we're able to use the product for it. And really, the knowledge of butchering is starting to make a comeback. The respect for being able to use that and have the ability to utilize a whole animal or a large portion of an animal and feature it in the restaurants is really starting to come back, especially with the scare that we've been going through with transportation costs and fuel and being able to stay local, and with how we've gone to rely so much on transportation now, can we really bring it back and survive in a smaller climate?
Thank you so much, Adam.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Adam is one of the chef instructors at Culinary School of the Rockies in Boulder, Colorado. Find out more about their curriculum at kcrw.com/goodfood. Before there was formula for infants, there was mother's milk. And if you had a problem with breastfeeding, you just had to turn to a woman who was producing it herself to help you. Today, there are women who believe breast is best and want no formula to pass their baby's lips. Enter the Breast Milk Bank, a unique service that accepts excess breast milk from some and sends it out to those who really need it. Details coming up when Good Food continues on KCRW and KCRW.com. From tofu to tenderloin, we talk about all sorts of food on this show. But before, as adults, we get to have four-course meals, we all started with something much more basic. Breast milk is the first food for many babies. Its healing properties are especially valuable to a baby with health problems. But what if the mom isn't able to breastfeed the baby? Here's where the Mother's Milk Bank comes in. With me is Pauline Sakamoto from the Mother's Milk Bank. So tell me what the Mother's Milk Bank does.
Well, we're a nonprofit organization who's been in operation for about 34 years. And basically, our main goal is to collect human milk from moms who are breastfeeding their own children And we process the milk and provide that service of processing the milk and then distribute it to babies, to infants in the hospital or in the home by physician's prescriptions. Now, these infants are typically children who have tried other food sources and cannot tolerate them. And we find that by the use of human milk in their diet, they do relatively well.
So if there's, for example, a preterm baby who's in the NICU, mm-hmm. and for some reason they're not doing well on formula, they're just not gaining weight, give us an idea of how the breast milk can really impact this little tiny baby.
Simply put, there's certainly more live cell tissues in human milk that an infant can use that the formulas do not have. For example, one of the large components is the immune properties of human milk, you know, helps the infant avoid those types of infections acquired in the hospitals or infections just because of the immaturity of the child. And also, human milk has growth hormones specifically developed for infants. So, for example, a preterm infant who's intestinal tract is immature to assimilate the cow-based formulas. Actually, the human milk has growth hormones to mature that intestinal tract to build it up so that they can take in food sources, but also could avoid situations that could occur later in life that would present itself as allergies and sensitivities to certain foods.
Now, who is eligible to be a donor? Is it an easy thing to do?
It is very easy. I think that what we could say is that most of our donors are healthy mothers who have excess amount of milk while they're lactating and providing milk for their own babies. They go through a strenuous testing and screened by our lab, and the milk obviously is screened by our lab. It's amazing how much milk some of our donors can provide outside of feeding their own child. And one of the things that I do want your listeners to understand is that to be a donor to the milk bank, it's not similar to the other tissue banks in that, for example, like blood banking, because it's only a short period of time that you could donate milk. It's only when you're lactating and feeding your own child that you actually have that opportunity to provide milk to somebody else's infant. So it's really a special, special service and actually a volunteer service that these women do.
It's such an incredible service. I want to thank you very much for coming here and sharing the Mother's Milk Bank story with us.
Thank you.
Pauline Sakamoto is the executive director of Mother's Milk Bank. The link is on our site at kcrw.com/goodfood.
I've eaten many things in my life, more than the average person, I suspect, but I've never tasted whale meat. My next guest has, though. He went on an incredible journey to document an Alaskan tribal whale hunt, how a small group of men can kill and drag a 40-ton beast up out of the water is truly astounding. I'll have all the details next when Good Food returns. That's in 1 minute, right here on KCRW and KCRW.com.
Jonathan Harris is an interesting guy. He's a Brooklyn-based web artist who decided that he would document the whale hunt in Barrow, Alaska. He took 3,214 photos, And then he put them all together in this absolutely unique format that I think may be the first time I've ever seen something made for the web that really exploits the artisticness and everything you can do with the web. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi.
Tell me the story of the particular group of Eskimos that you ended up hanging with for this whale hunt.
Well, basically, it's a community, quite a small one, up in Barrow, Alaska, which is the northernmost town in the United States. I connected with this family up there called the Putkatuk family and lived with them for 9 days. And the family was headed by this guy, Simeon Putkatuk, who is the whaling captain, and he was about 84 years old and incredibly respected member of the community.
What's life like for them in Barrow, Alaska? I would imagine that they straddle these two worlds, like even in their house.
Yeah, it's full of contradictions, mainly for logistical reasons because, you know, the ground is frozen 11 months a year up there, so it's impossible to plant or grow anything. So any food has to either be hunted or imported. So that makes things very expensive up there, like a, you know, bottle of Tropicana orange juice, which would cost $3 in New York, costs maybe, you know, $9 up there.
And in terms of food, a bag of Cheetos or a box of Fruit Loops can sit side by side with frozen whale meat.
Well, they don't sell whale. They're not allowed to sell whale meat to anybody, including to themselves. So whale meat's not sold in stores. It's all given for free to members of the community. But basically, the community has a quota, an annual quota, that allows them to kill a maximum of 22 whales. And that's a number that they reach through discussions with scientists. And they revise that quota every few years based on, you know, projections of whale populations.
On the particular whale hunt that you were on, were there more than one family that participated in the hunt?
It's all dependent on what the ice is doing. So basically, in the springtime, the frozen Arctic Ocean starts to melt. It starts to break open. And at first, it's just this little crack in the ice that can be, you know, 1 or 2 feet wide. And that reveals a canal of open ocean water underneath the ice there. And that canal gradually increases in width until, when we got there, it was about 9 miles wide. The 27 whaling crews all set up camp simultaneously up and down the edge of this lead, and each captain is responsible for picking the spot where his crew is going to camp out. And this ice it's not like the frozen ice of a lake that most Americans might be familiar with. It's just crazy, kind of, it looks like the surface of the moon. I mean, you have these ice boulders that are 12 feet high, 20 feet high, and it's not really flat at all.
Do they take the whales by harpooning?
Yeah, there's laws around that. So the way the law works is that they have to make the first strike with a harpoon, with a traditional harpoon. No guns, no motorboats. And so what they do is they have this boat called an umiak, which is a wooden framed boat that's wrapped in sealskin. And it's a very lightweight boat. And they have it propped up right on the edge of the ice with its bow in the water and its stern up on an ice block. And the harpoon is lying at the ready inside that boat. And then when a whale is sighted, it's kind of this exhilarating thing because you only have about 7 seconds to react. From when the whale starts to surface, he'll breathe, and he'll normally breathe for about 10 seconds, and then he'll smack his tail and go under again for about another hour. The harpooner runs over to the boat and leaps into the boat and grabs the harpoon, and the other guys in the camp, all dressed in white so they camouflage with the snow, they run over very quietly to the umiak and they push the umiak out into the water, out towards the whale. And the umiak basically glides out with no noise towards the breathing whale, and then as it comes close, the harpooner takes the harpoon and throws it at the whale.
And, so it's just one guy.
It's just one guy that makes that first strike, yeah. And that's a very privileged position to be the harpooner. He's typically one of the strongest, hardiest men in the group. And then once that harpoon strikes the whale, then they're allowed to use modern tools to finish off the kill. And the reason for that is it's actually a lot more humane. In the old days, they used to not use modern tools at all. So what they would do is they would basically just poke the whale with harpoons repeatedly until it bled to death. And that could take, you know, hours. And it was an incredibly gruesome thing. Now what they do is once they've struck that initial harpoon, they're allowed to use a whaling gun. And that would hopefully kill the whale instantly, which is kind of the most humane way to do it.
Once the whale has been killed,
I would imagine then the harvest, the bringing of the whale onto the ice, must have to happen with incredible rapidity so that he doesn't start to sink.
That's right, yeah. I mean, these whales are about 40 feet long and weighing about 45 tons, so they're huge. And when you first kill it, you know, it still maintains its buoyancy because it has air inside, but that gradually starts to diminish over time. So what they do is they take out a motorboat once the whale has been killed, and then they wrap this nylon burlap strap around its tail, and connected to that strap is a very, very strong rope. And then they basically tow the whale in using the motorboat to the edge of the ice.
Now, you have really extraordinary photographs of this long line of people spread out along a rope, pulling the whale from the tail onto the ice. How many people does it take to do that?
When I was there, I saw two whales pulled up, and the first one took about 100 people on the rope, and the second one was about 70 people on the rope. And there's this whole system of winches and pulleys that allow the people to move this massive weight.
So then the whale is finally completely on the ice, and then the cuts in the blubber start being made. Is there a ritual about the first cut? Who does it?
There's not a ritual about who does it, but there is a ritual about what the first cut is. I mean, the first thing they do is they pour water over the blowhole of the whale, and that's kind of a spiritual thing to let the whale's spirit return to the ocean. And then they basically they take these blades and they demarcate off strips along the back of the whale, each strip being maybe about 6 inches wide. And then right at the center of the back, they mark two X's in those center strips, and those X's mean that the whaling captain gets to keep those two strips because that's considered the best meat.
What does the actual whale meat taste like?
Well, the meat itself kind of tastes like a fishy version of roast beef. It's kind of roast beef with a fishy aftertaste.
Really extraordinary. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
You've really got to see Jonathan Harris's presentation of his experience in Alaska on the whale hunt. I've got the link at kcrw.com/goodfood. Jonathan is one of those polymaths who combines elements of computer science, anthropology, visual arts, and storytelling. He's done some incredible computer work, and I look forward to experiencing his next project.
Do you have a cat? I have to admit that I have several. Most likely, you cat owners have been feeding your cat fish meal of some sort, whether or not you even know it. This fish meal is wild fish, and it's contributing to a decimation of the fish population in the open oceans. Does Fluffy really need to eat this stuff? I'm Evan Kleinman, and Good Food will be right back on KCRW and KCRW.com. I love my kitties, but one thing I never do is feed them canned fish products of any kind. It's bad enough that we humans are eating the oceans to death, but to hasten the process by feeding wild fish to pets, I don't think so. Paul Greenberg is a writer living in New York City with extensive experience reporting on seafood and ocean issues. His recent New York Times article on our kitties in the sea was quite thought-provoking. So did you feed your kitty tuna?
Well, you know, I never fed him tuna directly out of the can. We fed him just standard pet food. And the thing is that pet food, regardless of, you know, how it's labeled, oftentimes will contain fish meal or fish oil that is derived from wild fish. So even if it's not particularly identified as a fish product, it's one of those sort of supplements that ends up in cat food. So, you know, they're going to eat wild fish, chances are, no matter what they're eating. But, I mean, I think the larger issue here, even beyond pets themselves, is that we continue to use wild fish from harvested from the sea, not just for pet food, but for all kinds of animal food. the pigs that, you know, that we eat, I think 20% of the world's fish meal and fish oil goes to pigs. Another 15-20% of that goes to chickens. And then, of course, the big consumer, 40% of wild fish feed, 40-50%, depending on what numbers you take, goes to the aquaculture industry and salmon and other things like that. And I'd say right now, you know, this is a tradition that's been going on for a long time. I mean, the fish that we're talking about that ends up in animal feed are primarily small pelagic fish, sardines, anchovies, mostly caught off of Peru and Chile. But once upon a time, all kinds of fish were ground up into feed. I mean, 50, 60 years ago, bluefin tuna ended up in all kinds of feed. And now, you know, they're talking about there being as few as 9,000 spawning bluefin tuna in the Western Atlantic. All kinds of people within the feed industry will make arguments that this is a sustainable thing that we're doing. We're only extracting a sustainable portion from the sea. But sustainable to what end? Yes, sustainable that we'll continue probably to be able to harvest anchovies for human use. But what about all those other creatures that would eat anchovies in the seas? Seals, whales, all sorts of animals, even larger fish that we depend on for our food. So I just feel like that it's a disrespectful attitude towards the sea if we're just using stuff for feed.
Well, also, it just seems insane to me that if nature has evolved these animals that are so efficient, they can take grass and turn it into protein, why would we want to even do anything else? I mean, that's an extraordinary natural system.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's true. And I think, you know, like much of industrial agriculture, it's a question of efficiency and, you know, getting the least cost input to get the most meat output. You know, the thing I didn't realize is that one of the reasons that fish meal is used so extensively, fish meal and fish oil in the swine industry for pigs, is that it's used as the best thing to wean piglets off of mother's milk. I don't know why that's so, but I find it strange, and I can't help but think that that must be something that was shown to be super efficient in that you could probably get piglets off of mother's milk more quickly, which probably means you can start turning them on to, you know, a solid diet more quickly, which in turn brings them to market more quickly. So it's, you know, it's speed and cost ultimately.
So throw us a bone. Give us something that's positive.
Well, you know, I will say that the U.S., both the swine industry and the poultry industry, have been using less and less fish feed. But in turn, what's been happening is that huge international market is now directed to China and East Asia, where, you know, a lot of cheap meat products are being made and then in turn sent back to the United States. So I guess the bone on one hand is that the U.S. industry seems to have recognized that there is something askew here, is lowering their use. The other thing, though, that's on the horizon is that, you know, NOAA, which oversees the National Marine Fisheries Service and a large aquaculture research program, is looking into alternatives to pelagic fish as feed. I do think that there's a great deal of potential with algae. I'm told that certain algal compounds can actually produce some of the omega-3s that are sort of the key element that you need to have, that many animals get from fish feed. So I actually think that there, you know, with more research and investment in that line of thinking, we could potentially find our way out of this trap. But at the same time, you know, it's a good thing to plant a flag in and show, you know, that there is this just continued use and misuse of the sea in a kind of arbitrary fashion, you know, as if it's just this free resource that we can dip our ladle into whenever we want to.
Thank you so much, Paul.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Paul Greenberg's a regular contributor to the New York Times on seafood issues. He's also the author of a forthcoming book on the future of fish. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood to read Paul Greenberg's New York Times op-ed piece on cat feed. How best to help starving people, especially children, has been the focus of Doctors Without Borders. While donating large bags of grain to families can fill stomachs, there's actually a lot of nutrition that's missing. When Good Food returns, I'll tell you some of the strategies for feeding hungry children. That's next on KCRW and KCRW.com. ¶¶ If we're feeling economically insecure, imagine those who already face unimaginable challenges just to feed their children. At a time of increasing food prices and food insecurity worldwide, a new issue before USAID programs is to take a look at the quality, not just the quantity, of food assistance, particularly for children under five. Dr. Budi Lokuge is manager of Doctors Without Borders' Access to Essential Medicines campaign. Tell me the type of food aid that you typically see arrive in areas of extreme malnutrition, and how that food aid plays out in terms of affecting or not affecting malnutrition in young children.
Well, food aid really can and does provide a very important safety net to families living on the margins, you know, in crisis, but also in chronic areas where every year there's food insecurity before the harvest. But we've tended to focus on the quantity of food, on moving bulk quantities of agricultural goods, you know, and that doesn't address the needs of young children. Good food, nutritious food, is really what we all need, and particularly young children. And in food aid programs, we just haven't been doing that.
Because a lot of the aid that gets there isn't protein.
It's really grain-based. It's corn based on things that we had in surplus, but that's not what young children need to grow.
Several years ago, I remember we first started hearing about a ready-to-eat nutritional supplement called Plumpy Nut.
That's right. Therapeutic foods were something that transformed the way we can treat severely malnourished children. You give it to a child that's just on the brink of death, and in a matter of days, you see them getting their energy back. In crisis settings, we've been able to reach hundreds of thousands of children.
Describe what these foods are. What are they made of?
It's very simple, actually. It's basically a mixture of oil and sugar, but with milk as well, and then a mineral and vitamin mix to give a balance and nutrition to children.
And so the oil is in the form of peanut butter?
Peanut butter is the flavor, actually. And in parts of Africa, it's actually something that kids like to eat. So you can make a good medicine, but if it's bitter, as we all know from childhood, we're not going to take it. Whereas this, it's tasty, and so children like to eat it. And that's partly why we achieve 90% success rates in terms of recovery with this outpatient approach.
Are these products, like Plumpy Nut, for example, this mixture of peanut butter and sugar and other nutrients, is it made there in country?
Absolutely. There's a real big push to do that because it's so simple. We've found local business women, for example, in some of the places we worked, who have set up factories. And there's a real push now to set these up in local production sites up in many high-burden countries.
I would imagine that one of the great benefits of it is that it requires no water for hydration, since water is always such a marginal thing.
Yeah, look, exactly. I mean, children need safe water. It doesn't require any added water, like, for example, the therapeutic milks we used to have to make. That can very quickly be a toxin to children if it's not refrigerated. So it wasn't safe to send children home with these. These products, because they can't be contaminated, they have oil content, like peanut butter, bacteria can't get into them. So it's safe to use at home. It doesn't need added water. It doesn't need refrigeration. And it means it really works in the real world in these most difficult parts.
So what I'm curious about is, given that there's this new generation of foods that can sort of miraculously bring children back from the brink, is USAID starting to take some of the massive amount of money that's used and put them towards these kinds of new elements for malnutrition?
We're at the very early days. You know, if we just look at severe acute malnutrition, today only about 5% of all the children in the world who need it, the severely malnourished who are really at risk, have access to treatment. So we need to see a shift in the way we prioritize programs. And then looking at food aid, it is a resource that could have a big impact on malnutrition, but there really needs to be three changes to happen. The first is that to prioritize countries where the deaths are occurring, the areas of chronic malnutrition. they often occur outside famines or crises, and so there's no cameras there, there's no political interest. That's happening in silence.
And where would this be?
It's parts of Africa, so the Sahel, the Horn of Africa, West Africa, and then in parts of Southern Asia. It's only a few countries that account for the burden of malnutrition. We need to prioritize those through food aid. We need to prioritize women and children, which is the groups that are most vulnerable, pregnant women and young children. And then we need to make sure that the food aid we give has appropriate, nutritious food for young children. People are starting to realize that we need to look at this, but we're a long way from actually change happening that would help organizations like us and national governments actually support these children and families.
I went on your site and I watched some videos, and it seemed nearly miraculous how children who were so close to the edge could be so resurrected, really, through such a simple feeding process.
You know, to a parent, it just breaks you. When you see the, just with a little bit of help, a mother bring her child back, it's in front of your eyes. It makes you upset that whether because we don't see these children or because we've got so many other priorities, or it's not a lot of money in the global scale of things, the funding to support these programs. And you want to do all you can to tell the story because it really is miraculous.
If someone wants to donate, for example, specifically to having the pool of money be larger to buy these specialized foods, where can we go?
Ultimately, organizations like ours will not reach most of the children in these areas. It has to be national governments with a bit of international support.
What about contacting our representatives in terms of lobbying to get decision makers to put aside more money for these foods?
It has to be like we have done with HIV. The international community says we won't stand for this anymore. You know, as parents, we really don't see why children should be dying each year from malnutrition. And we hope we can do that and we can get people really to care about malnutrition, because with a little bit of interest and action, we could have a big impact.
Dr. Budi Lokuge is the manager of Access to Essential Medicines campaign. More details are at kcrw.com/goodfood. If I told you that making perfect bread at home was easy, would you believe me? Well, it is. It's so simple, in fact, that you barely have to touch the dough. The minimalist Mark Bittman is with me next when Good Food returns. You're listening to 89.9 KCRW and kcrw.com. When the New York Times' Mark Bittman first wrote about a no-knead bread recipe, the article spread across the internet like wildfire. It was the paper's most emailed article for weeks. Ask anyone who's made the bread, and they say that they felt like they reached a kind of culinary nirvana. So we thought we'd ask Mark Bittman the story behind this no-knead bread.
This bread is truly a no-knead bread. It's captured everybody's imagination because it works, and because those of us who have worked on making good European-style bread at home for 30 or 40 years, as people my age have done, and constantly feel like we're climbing this ladder towards something approaching decent or perfect or whatever, we're suddenly thrown for a loop by this bread that takes no work and is, like, unbelievable.
Okay, so where did you learn this new technique?
This is technique was put together by this guy, Jim Leahy, who owns Sullivan Street Bakery, which is a bakery in New York, who sent me an email that said, I have this technique for bread that a kid could do and will produce better bread with no work than most bakeries in the city, including my own. So, you want to hear them?
I definitely want to hear them.
One, he makes a very, very wet dough, almost as wet as a starter, which if you make bread, you know, a starter is too wet to handle. There's a lot of water in there. I mean, to wit, I've adapted the recipe a little bit, but at this point, I'm now using 4 cups of flour and 2 cups of water. He uses very, very little yeast, 1/4 teaspoon. To compensate for that, his rising times are really, really long. So you mix this wet batter with a little bit of yeast, and it's just flour, water, salt, yeast, and then you let it sit for about 18 hours. And it's less if...
I love that throwaway line.
Then you walk away from it.
Then you let it sit for 18 hours. Now, does it sit in the refrigerator or does it sit outside on a counter?
70 degrees is ideal. The yeast activates. Yeast breeds yeast. So over this long period of time, it does the equivalent of kneading, which is to say it creates gluten. It activates the gluten that's inherent in the flour.
What does this really long, slow rise with very little yeast do to the flavor of the bread?
It develops the good bready flavor of good bread. It tastes very wheaty, and it tastes a tiny bit sour, and it doesn't taste very yeasty. And when you add whole wheat, you really taste that. And when you add rye or cornmeal, it's out of this world. I mean, you really, really, those flavors come forward.
What does this really loose dough look like after the 18 hours?
So after 18 hours, it's bubbly and it's wet. It looks quite wet. And if you tilt the bowl or whatever you have it rising in, you'll see the long strands of gluten that you see when you make a starter. And that's really a cool thing to see. And you turn it out onto a floured counter and it looks much too wet to handle. But lo and behold, when you sprinkle it with a little bit of flour, it stays very, very soft and becomes not handleable in the sense that you could squeeze it, but handleable in the sense that you can just barely shape it. And that's what you want to do. You then shape it and you let it rest for another couple or 3 hours. Although there are people who are baking it almost straight after this, and I don't like those results as well, but it can be done. So then you wait another couple hours, and then, and this is the part that really gets people, then you bake it in a covered pot.
I love this. This is like genius. So you've risen it the second time, so it's at the mm-hmm. point where if you touch it, it doesn't spring back, I would expect.
Not as much, right? It's not as resistant.
And then what do? Slide it off the counter and plop it in a pan?
You slide your hand underneath it. I mean, there's a couple different ways of doing this. But however you manage to do it, you plop this into a preheated, while the oven's preheating, you preheat a cast iron or a Le Creuset or a heavy pot with a cover, and you plop it into this preheated pot, and it looks a little bit like a mess. And you put the cover on the pot, and you cook it for 20 or 30 minutes that way. You take the cover off, and lo and behold, you have this beautifully rounded, formed bread, and then you bake it with the cover off for another 20 or 30 minutes until it's done, and it's gorgeous.
Is this the kind of bread you like to eat warm, or do you let it cool down?
You got to let it cool down. It has to rest. I once read something by some old food writer about how the bread must rest before it is introduced to the knife.
So
you have to wait a while before it's introduced to the knife.
And then describe the final product.
The final product, if you do 1/3 rye flour, is the closest thing I've seen to a Poilain bread.
Who is Poilain?
Poilain is this famous French baker who in the 80s, I guess, went back to the old recipes and developed a very dense bread with some rye flour in it that had a great crust. And so we're not talking about an elegant baguette. We're talking about a peasant loaf with a solid but not hard crust, crackly, the inside having those shiny, beautiful tunnels or cells of gluten, really, really good, well-developed flavor. It's perfectly shaped. I mean, that's the other thing. I cannot tell you how much time I've spent shaping boule. And then here's this thing which you plop into a pot and it looks awful and it comes out and it looks like, you know, you could charge $8 a loaf for this stuff.
Mark, thank you so much for being a purveyor of deliciousness.
You're welcome, Evan.
Mark Bittman first wrote about Jim Leahy's No Need Bread in his minimalist column in the New York Times. Jim Leahy's book, My Bread, is the latest selection in the Good Food Cookbook Club. It's a wonderful book with step-by-step instructions for perfect, easy bread. Go to kcrw.com/join to find out more about the Cookbook Club. Bread is delicious, that's for sure. But is it cute? Maybe in Japan. Japanese have cornered that market with the cutest presentation of food ever. I'll introduce you to the bento, the Japanese lunchbox food that's turned into cherubim, the cute and creative characters made from food. That's coming up next on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. If you think just putting a bunch of great-tasting healthy food into a lunchbox is what makes you a devoted mom, well, you should take a look at what some Japanese mothers are giving to their children in their lunchboxes. Christopher Salyers has written a book called Face Food, The Visual Creativity of Japanese Bento Boxes. Describe what we're talking about.
Well, they're called charaben, which is a blend of the word character and bento. I'm sure most people know what a bento box is, which is just a sort of a square rectangular lunchbox. These charaben are made for children, so they're basically a kid's lunchbox. And they form the food into various shapes. It could be a scene, it could be their favorite cartoon character, it could be anything.
The thing about these charabens is that the level of craft are pretty extraordinary. The mothers will take a favorite cartoon character, like Piglet, let's say, and the kid will open up their box and there's Piglet in a landscape. How dedicated does a mom have to be to make these bento lunches?
I mean, this really is a very intense craft. I compare it to the way a lot of Americans treat birthday cakes. Like, for instance, Ace of Cakes on Food Network. A lot of people watch that show, and there's a lot of practice time involved in really perfecting this skill of making charaben. But it's something that a lot of mothers love to do because it pleases their children.
It's interesting to me because it seems like there's two different styles. One style is this sort of almost two-dimensional where some of the mothers in particular seem extremely skilled at doing like manga characters using flat ingredients like maybe cheese where they're actually cutting it out and then using nori and other things to put hair or whatever, and they look really real.
They really go that extra step in perfecting these using anything they can find around the home to really make these shapes pop out and look like the manga character or what have you.
Of course, manga are the Japanese comics, which are really, really popular with children.
They use everything from tweezers to X-Acto knives to straws to toothpicks or lids and other containers from other objects to form these shapes.
Another style besides this sort of flat style seems to me the more sculptural style. Like you have a cherubim box that has three little pigs, and the little pigs' heads are made out of a pink tinted rice balls.
And it's surprisingly really easy to dye rice just with food coloring. You just sort of throw it in there while it's cooking, or you can even mix it in together after the rice has already been cooked.
What are some of the ingredients that seem to be, as well as a healthy food, a good art project ingredient?
The two main staples are rice, sort of for your background, and nori for your detail work. Most of the outlines of people that are carved is usually bologna or cheese. A lot of eggs are used, and a lot of tomatoes as well.
How did you come upon these women? Do they get together, or do they have online chat rooms where they talk to one another?
This phenomenon really sprung about with the popularity of the internet. It's a really, really new phenomenon, and a lot of the mothers photograph the bentos before they give it to their kid in the morning, and a lot of them blog about it. And there are even communities or little groups that get together and meet once a month, and they share their bento designs.
It seems with many of these mothers, especially the one who's working with the manga characters.
I think Nico?
Yeah, Nico. She gets up at 5:30 in the morning to start making these. Is that typical?
Yeah, on average, the really skilled mothers and father that I met, they spend maybe 40 minutes every morning, but most everybody else, it takes about 2 hours to do one. Me as well. It takes 2 or 3 hours, actually.
Is there a competitive nature for this, or is it pretty selfless? Like, the whole idea is to imagine your child opening the box at school.
There's that, but they're also opening the box so that they can sort of look cool in school.
Oh.
And so they can have the coolest Charaben. And so there's definitely some competition going on.
So the competition isn't so much between the mothers, it's between the kids.
Exactly. But a lot of small boys really voice up and complain even about some of their Charaben that they, you know, it doesn't, you know, look just like Astro Boy.
Like Nico's son, I would imagine, over time became more and more critical.
Oh, absolutely. It got to the point where he was basically complaining about almost every lunch that she was making for him because he wanted more mature characters, even though he was 10, you know, to be getting these kids' characters. And this one particular day, he couldn't stand it, and he gave it back to his mother and said, "This looks nothing like it. I don't want this at all." And, you know, what is she supposed to do with this lunch that it took her 2 hours to prepare in the morning? And she either gives it to her husband, or if he doesn't want it, then it goes in the garbage, unfortunately.
Oh, that's just too sad. Now, what about the taste?
I actually asked every single mother that I interviewed, how do you rank these three? One, nutrition; two, taste; and three, visual appeal. And not a single one put taste first.
So it's all about getting the smile from the kid.
Well, I guess it is mostly about getting the smile from the kid. But from the mother's point of view, it's about getting that kid to eat the certain healthy foods that that kid doesn't want to eat.
Face Food, the visual creativity of Japanese bento boxes, is Chris Saylor's book on Charaben, or Japanese bento box art. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood for pictures and links to a blog with amazing entries. You can podcast or download this show, find all past episodes and lots of great video at kcrw.com/goodfood. Tell us what you think. We want to know. Click on today's show and scroll down to the comments section. We've got all kinds of great information, recipes, videos, and also a lot of pictures on the Good Food blog. You can find it at kcrw.com/goodfood. Also, if you love Twitter, you can find me there. I'm at Evan Kleiman, that's K-L-E-I-M-A-N, and spend some time with your food friends, of course, on Facebook. Follow my fan page there. Good Food's executive producer is Jennifer Farrow. Harriet Els produced and edited the program with Bob Carlson, Connie Alvarez, Candace Moyer, Holly Tarson, and Jillian Ferguson. I'm Evan Kleiman. See you next week for another edition of Good Food.